How the Brigadier Held the King. Here, upon the lapel of my coat, you may see the ribbon of my decoration, but the medal itself I keep in a leathern pouch at home. And I never venture to take it out unless one of the modern peace generals, or some foreigner of distinction who finds himself in our little town, takes advantage of the opportunity to pay his respects to the well-known Brigadier Gerard. Then I place it upon my breast, and I give my moustache the old Marengo twist, which brings a grey point into either eye. Yet with it all, I fear that neither they nor you either, my friends, will ever realize the man that I was. You know me only as a civilian, with an air and a manner, it is true, but still merely as a civilian. Had you seen me as I stood in the doorway of the inn at Alamo on the 1st of July in the year 1810, you would then have known what the hussar may attain to. For a month I had lingered in that accursed village, and all on account of a lance thrust in my ankle, which made it impossible for me to put my foot to the ground. There were three besides myself at first: old Bouvet of the Hussars of Berchenay, Jacques Regnier of the Cuirassiers, and a funny little voltigeur captain, whose name I forget. But they all got well and hurried on to the front, while I sat gnawing my fingers and tearing my hair, and even, I must confess, weeping from time to time as I thought of my Hussars of Conflans, and the deplorable condition in which they must find themselves when deprived of their colonel. I was not a chief of brigade yet, you understand, although I already carried myself like one, but I was the youngest colonel in the whole service, and my regiment was wife and children to me. It went to my heart that they should be so bereaved. It is true that Villeray, the senior major, was an excellent soldier, but still, even among the best, there are degrees of merit. Ah, that happy July day of which I speak, when first I limped to the door and stood in the golden Spanish sunshine. It was but the evening before that I had heard from the regiment. They were at Pastores, on the other side of the mountains, face to face with the English, not 40 miles from me by road. But how was I to get to them? The same thrust which had pierced my ankle had slain my charger. I took advice both from Gomez, the landlord, and from an old priest who had slept that night in the inn. But neither of them could do more than assure me that there was not so much as a colt left upon the whole countryside. The landlord would not hear of my crossing the mountains without an escort, for he assured me that El Cutillo, the Spanish guerrilla chief, was out that way with his band, and that it meant a death by torture to fall into his hands. The old priest observed, however, that he did not think a French hussar would be deterred by that, and if I had had any doubts, they would of course have been decided by his remark. But a horse? How was I to get one? I was standing in the doorway, plotting and planning, when I heard the clink of shoes, and looking up I saw a great bearded man with a blue cloak frogged across in military fashion coming towards me. He was riding a big black horse with one white stocking on his near foreleg. "Hello, comrade," said I as he came up to me. "Hello," said he. "I am Colonel Gerard of the Hussars," said I. "I have lain here wounded for a month, and I am now ready to rejoin my regiment at Pastores." "I am Monsieur Vidal of the Commissariat," he answered, "and I am myself upon my way to Pastores. I should be glad to have your company, Colonel, for I hear that the mountains are far from safe." "Alas," said I have no horse. "But if you will sell me yours, I will promise that an escort of hussars shall be sent back for you." He would not hear of it, and it was in vain that the landlord told him dreadful stories of the doings of El Cutillo, and that I pointed out the duty which he owed to the army and to the country. He would not even argue, but called loudly for a cup of wine. I craftily asked him to dismount and to drink with me, but he must have seen something in my face, for he shook his head, and then as I approached him with some thought of seizing him by the leg, he jerked his heels into his horse's flanks and was off in a cloud of dust. My faith, it was enough to make a man mad to see this fellow riding away so gaily to join his beef barrels and his brandy casks, and then to think of my 500 beautiful hussars without their leader. I was gazing after him with bitter thoughts in my mind when who should touch me on the elbow but the little priest whom I have mentioned. "It is I who can help you," he said. "I am myself travelling south." I put my arms about him, and, as my ankle gave way at the same moment, we nearly rolled on the ground together. "Get me to Pastores," I cried, "and you shall have a rosary of golden beads." I had taken one from the convent of Spiritu Santo. It shows how necessary it is to take what you can when you are upon a campaign, and how the most unlikely things may become useful. "I will take you," he said, in very excellent French, "not because I hope for any reward, but because it is my way, always, to do what I can to serve my fellow man. And that is why I am so beloved wherever I go." With that he led me down to the village to an old cowhouse, in which we found a tumble-down sort of diligence, such as they used to run early in this century, between some of our remote villages. There were three old mules, too, none of which were strong enough to carry a man, but together they might draw the coach. The sight of their gaunt ribs and spavined legs gave me more delight than the whole 220 hunters of the Emperor, which I have seen in their stalls at Fontainebleau. In 10 minutes the owner was harnessing them into the coach, with no very good will, however, for he was in mortal dread of this terrible Cutillo. It was only by promising him riches in this world, while the priest threatened him with perdition in the next, that we at last got him safely upon the box, with the reins between his fingers. Then he was in such a hurry to get off, out of fear lest we should find ourselves in the dark in the passes, that he hardly gave me time to renew my vows to the innkeeper's daughter. I cannot at this moment recall her name, but we wept together as we parted, and I can remember that she was a very beautiful woman. You will understand, my friends, that when a man like me, who has fought the men and kissed the women in 14 separate kingdoms, gives a word of praise to the one or the other, it has a little meaning of its own. The little priest had seemed a trifle grave when we kissed goodbye, but he soon proved himself the best of companions in the diligence. All the way he amused me with tales of his little parish up in the mountains, and I, in my turn, told him stories about the camp. But my faith, I had to pick my steps, for when I said a word too much, he would fidget in his seat, and his face would show the pain that I had given him. And of course it is not the act of a gentleman to talk in anything but a proper manner to a religious man, though with all the care in the world one's words may get out of hand sometimes. He had come from the north of Spain, as he told me, and was going to see his mother in a village of Estremadura. And as he spoke about her little peasant home and her joy in seeing him, it brought my own mother so vividly to my thoughts that the tears started to my eyes. In his simplicity he showed me the little gifts which he was taking to her, and so kindly was his manner that I could readily believe him when he said he was loved wherever he went. He examined my own uniform with as much curiosity as a child, admiring the plume of my busby, and passing his fingers through the sable with which my dolman was trimmed. He drew my sword, too, And then, when I told him how many men I had cut down with it, and set my finger on the notch made by the shoulder bone of the Russian Emperor's aide-de-camp, he shuddered and placed the weapon under the leathern cushion, declaring that it made him sick to look at it. Well, we had been rolling and creaking on our way whilst this talk had been going forward, and as we reached the base of the mountains we could hear the rumbling of cannon far away upon the right. This came from Massena, who was, as I knew, besieging Ciudad Rodrigo. There was nothing I should have wished better than to have gone straight to him, for if, as some said, he had Jewish blood in his veins, he was the best Jew that I have heard of since Joshua's time. If you were in sight of his beaky nose and bold black eyes, you were not likely to miss much of what was going on. Still, a siege is always a poor sort of pick-and-shovel business, and there were better prospects with my hussars in front of the English. Every mile that passed, my heart grew lighter and lighter, until I found myself shouting and singing like a young ensign fresh from Saint-Cyr, just to think of seeing all my fine horses and my gallant fellows once more. As we penetrated the mountains, the road grew rougher and the pass more savage. At first we had met a few muleteers, but now the whole country seemed deserted, which is not to be wondered at when you think that the French, the English, and the guerrillas had each in turn had command over it. So bleak and wild it was, one great brown wrinkled cliff succeeding another, and the pass growing narrower and narrower, that I ceased to look out but sat in silence, thinking of this and that, of women whom I had loved, and of horses which I had handled. I was suddenly brought back from my dreams, however, by observing the difficulties of my companion, who was trying, with a sort of bradawl, which he had drawn out, to bore a hole through the leathern strap which held up his water flask. As he worked with twitching fingers, the strap escaped his grasp, and the wooden bottle fell at my feet. I stooped to pick it up, and as I did so, the priest silently leapt upon my shoulders and drove his bradawl into my eye. My friends, I am, as you know, a man steeled to face every danger. When one has served, from the affair of Zurich to that last fatal day of Waterloo, and has had the special medal, which I keep at home in a leathern pouch, one can afford to confess when one is frightened. It may console some of you, when your own nerves play you tricks, to remember that you have heard even me, Brigadier Gerard, say that I have been scared. And besides my terror at this horrible attack, and the maddening pain of my wound, there was a sudden feeling of loathing, such as you might feel were some filthy tarantula to strike its fangs into you. I clutched the creature in both hands, and hurling him onto the floor of the coach, I stamped on him with my heavy boots. He had drawn a pistol from the front of his soutane, but I kicked it out of his hand, and again I fell with my knees upon his chest. Then for the first time he screamed horribly, while I, half blinded, felt about for the sword which he had so cunningly concealed. My hand had just lighted upon it, and I was dashing the blood from my face to see where he lay that I might transfix him, when the whole coach turned partly over upon its side, and my weapon was jerked out of my grasp by the shock. Before I could recover myself, the door was burst open, and I was dragged by the heels onto the road. But even as I was torn out onto the flint stones and realized that 30 ruffians were standing around me, I was filled with joy, for my pelisse had been pulled over my head in the struggle and was covering one of my eyes, and it was with my wounded eye that I was seeing this gang of brigands. You see for yourself by this pucker and scar how the thin blade passed between socket and ball. but it was only at that moment when I was dragged from the coach that I understood that my sight was not gone forever. The creature's intention, doubtless, was to drive it through into my brain, and indeed he loosened some portion of the inner bone of my head, so that I afterwards had more trouble from that wound than from any one of the 17 which I have received. They dragged me out, these sons of dogs, with curses and execrations, beating me with their fists and kicking me as I lay upon the ground. I had frequently observed that the mountaineers wore cloth swathed round their feet, but never did I imagine that I should have so much cause to be thankful for it. Presently, seeing the blood upon my head, and that I lay quiet, they thought that I was unconscious, whereas I was storing every ugly face among them into my memory, so that I might see them all safely hanged if ever my chance came round. Brawny rascals they were, with yellow handkerchiefs round their heads and great red sashes stuffed with weapons. They had rolled two rocks across the path where it took a sharp turn, and it was these which had torn off one of the wheels of the coach and upset us. As to this reptile who had acted the priest so cleverly and had told me so much of his parish and his mother, he, of course, had known where the ambuscade was laid, and had attempted to put me beyond all resistance at the moment when we reached it. I cannot tell you how frantic their rage was when they drew him out of the coach and saw the state to which I had reduced him. If he had not got all his deserts, he had at least something as a souvenir of his meeting with Étienne Gérard, for his legs dangled aimlessly about. And though the upper part of his body was convulsed with rage and pain, he sat straight down upon his feet when they tried to set him upright. But all the time his two little black eyes, which had seemed so kindly and so innocent in the coach, were glaring at me like a wounded cat, and he spat and spat and spat in my direction. My faith, when the wretches jerked me onto my feet again, and when I was dragged up one of the mountain paths, I understood that a time was coming when I was to need all my courage and resource. My enemy was carried upon the shoulders of two men behind me, and I could hear his hissing and his reviling first in one ear and then in the other, as I was hurried up the winding track. I suppose that it must have been for an hour that we ascended, and what with my wounded ankle and the pain from my eye, and the fear lest this wound should have spoiled my appearance, I have made no journey to which I look back with less pleasure. I have never been a good climber at any time, but it is astonishing what you can do, even with a stiff ankle, when you have a copper-coloured brigand at each elbow and a 9-inch blade within touch of your whiskers. We came at last to a place where the path wound over a ridge, and descended upon the other side, through thick pine trees, into a valley which opened to the south. In time of peace I had little doubt that the villains were all smugglers, and that these were the secret paths by which they crossed the Portuguese frontier. There were many mule tracks, and once I was surprised to see the marks of a large horse where a stream had softened the track. These were explained when, on reaching a place where there was a clearing in the fir wood, I saw the animal itself halted to a fallen tree. My eyes had already rested upon it when I recognized the great black limbs and the white near foreleg. It was the very horse which I had begged for in the morning. What then had become of Commissariat Vidal? Was it possible that there was another Frenchman in as perilous a plight as myself? The thought had hardly entered my head when our party stopped, and one of them uttered a peculiar cry. It was answered from among the brambles which lined the base of a cliff at one side of a clearing. and an instant later 10 or 12 more brigands came out from amongst them, and the two parties greeted each other. The newcomers surrounded my friend of the Braddle with cries of grief and sympathy, and then, turning upon me, they brandished their knives and howled at me, like the gang of assassins that they were. So frantic were their gestures that I was convinced that my end had come, and was just bracing myself to meet it in a manner which should be worthy of my past reputation, when one of them gave an order, and I was dragged roughly across the little glade to the brambles from which this new band had emerged. A narrow pathway led through them to a deep grotto in the side of the cliff. The sun was already setting outside, and in the cave itself it would have been quite dark, but for a pair of torches which blazed from a socket on either side. Between them there was sitting, at a rude table, a very singular-looking person, whom I saw instantly, from the respect with which the others addressed him, could be none other than the brigand chief who had received, on account of his dreadful character, the sinister name of El Cutillo. The man whom I had injured had been carried in and placed upon the top of a barrel, his helpless legs dangling about in front of him, and his cat's eyes still darting glances of hatred at me. I understood, from the snatches of talk which I could follow between the chief and him, that he was the lieutenant of the band, and that part of his duties was to lie in wait with his smooth tongue and his peaceful garb for travellers like myself. When I thought of how many gallant officers may have been lured to their death by this monster of hypocrisy, it gave me a glow of pleasure to think that I had brought his villainies to an end, though I feared it would be at the price of a life which neither the Emperor nor the army could well spare. As the injured man, still supported upon the barrel by two comrades, was explaining in Spanish all that had befallen him, I was held by several of the villains in front of the table at which the chief was seated, and had an excellent opportunity of observing him. I have seldom seen any man who was less like my idea of a brigand, and especially of a brigand with such a reputation, that in a land of cruelty he had earned so dark a nickname. His face was bluff and broad and bland, with ruddy cheeks and comfortable little tufts of side whiskers, which gave him the appearance of a well-to-do grocer of the Rue Saint-Antoine. He had not any of those flaring sashes or gleaming weapons which distinguished his followers, but on the contrary he wore a good broadcloth coat like a respectable father of a family, and save for his brown leggings there was nothing to indicate a life among the mountains. His surroundings too corresponded with himself, and beside his snuff-box upon the table there stood a great brown book, which looked like a commercial ledger. Many other books were ranged along a plank between two powder casks, and there was a great litter of papers, some of which had verses scribbled upon them. All this I took in while he, leaning indolently back in his chair, was listening to the report of his lieutenant. Having heard everything, he ordered the cripple to be carried out again, and I was left with my three guards, waiting to hear my fate. He took up his pen, and tapping his forehead with the handle of it, he pursed up his lips and looked out of the corner of his eyes at the roof of the grotto. "I suppose," said he at last, speaking very excellent French, "that you are not able to suggest a rhyme for the word covilha." I answered him that my acquaintance with the Spanish language was so limited that I was unable to oblige him. "It is a rich language," said he, "but less prolific in rhymes than either the German or the English. That is why our best work has been done in blank verse. a form of composition which is capable of reaching great heights. But I fear that such subjects are somewhat outside the range of a hussar. I was about to answer that if they were good enough for a guerrilla, they could not be too much for the light cavalry. But he was already stooping over his half-finished verse. Presently he threw down the pen with an exclamation of satisfaction and declaimed a few lines which drew a cry of approval from the three ruffians who held me. His broad face blushed like a young girl who receives her first compliment. "The critics are in my favour, it appears," said he. "We amuse ourselves in our long evenings by singing our own ballads, you understand. I have some little facility in that direction, and I do not at all despair of seeing some of my poor efforts in print before long, and with Madrid upon the title page, too. But we must get back to business. May I ask what your name is?"
"Etienne Gerard."
"Rank?"
"Colonel."
"Corps?"
"The 3rd Hussars of Conflans."
"You are young for a colonel."
"My career has been an eventful one."
"Tuts, that makes it the sadder," said he with his bland smile. I made no answer to that, but I tried to show him by my bearing that I was ready for the worst which could befall me. "By the way, I rather fancy that we have had some of your corps here," said he, turning over the pages of his big brown register. "We endeavour to keep a record of our operations. Here is a heading under June 24th. Have you not a young officer named Souberon, a tall, slight youth with light hair?"
"Certainly."
"I see that we buried him upon that date."
"Poor lad," I cried. "And how did he die?"
"We buried him."
"But before you buried him..."
"You misunderstand me, Colonel. He was not dead before we buried him."
"You buried him alive?"
For a moment I was too stunned to act. Then I hurled myself upon the man as he sat with that placid smile of his upon his lips, and I would have torn his throat out had the three wretches not dragged me away from him. Again and again I made for him, panting and cursing, shaking off this man and that, straining and wrenching, but never quite free. At last, with my jacket torn nearly off my back and blood dripping from my wrists, I was hauled backwards in the bite of a rope, and cords passed round my ankles and my arms.
"You sleek hound," I cried, "if ever I have you at my sword's point, I will teach you to maltreat one of my lads. You will find, you bloodthirsty beast, that my emperor has long arms, and though you lie here like a rat in its hole, the time will come when he will tear you out of it, and you and your vermin will perish together."
My faith, I have a rough side to my tongue, and there was not a hard word that I had learned in 14 campaigns which I did not let fly at him. But he sat with the handle of his pen tapping against his forehead, and his eyes squinting up at the roof, as if he had conceived the idea of some new stanza. It was this occupation of his which showed me how I might get my point into him.
"You spawn," said I, "you think that you are safe here, but your life may be as short as that of your absurd verses, and God knows that it could not be shorter than that."
Ah, you should have seen him bound from his chair when I said the words. This vile monster, who dispensed death and torture as a grocer serves out his figs, had one raw nerve then, which I could prod at pleasure. His face grew livid, and those little bourgeois side whiskers quivered and thrilled with passion.
"Very good, Colonel, you have said enough," he cried in a choking voice. "You say that you have had a very distinguished career. I promise you also a very distinguished ending. Colonel Etienne Gerard of the 3rd Hussars shall have a death of his own."
"And I only beg," said I, "that you will not commemorate it in verse." I had one or two little ironies to utter, but he cut me short by a furious gesture which caused my three guards to drag me from the cave. Our interview, which I have told you, as nearly as I can remember it, must have lasted some time, for it was quite dark when we came out, and the moon was shining very clearly in the heavens. The brigands had lighted a great fire of the dried branches of the fir trees, not, of course, for warmth, since the night was already very sultry, but to cook their evening meal. A huge copper pot hung over the blaze, and the rascals were lying all round in the yellow glare, so that the scene looked like one of those pictures which Junot stole out of Madrid. There are some soldiers who profess to care nothing for art and the like, but I've always been drawn towards it myself, in which respect I show my good taste and my breeding. I remember, for example, that when Lefebvre was selling the plunder after the fall of Danzig, I bought a very fine picture called Nymphs Surprised in a Wood, and I carried it with me through two campaigns, until my charger had the misfortune to put his hoof through it. I only tell you this, however, to show you that I was never a mere rough soldier, like Rapp or Ney. As I lay in that brigand's camp, I had little time or inclination to think about such matters. They had thrown me down under a tree, the three villains squatting round and smoking their cigarettes within hand's touch of me. What to do I could not imagine. In my whole career I do not suppose that I have 10 times been in as hopeless a situation. But courage, thought I, courage, my brave boy. You were not made a colonel of hussars at 28 because you could dance a cotillon. You are a picked man, Etienne, a man who has come through more than 200 affairs, and this little one is surely not going to be the last. I began eagerly to glance about for some chance of escape, and as I did so I saw something which filled me with great astonishment. I have already told you that a large fire was burning in the centre of the glade. What with its glare, and what with the moonlight, everything was as clear as possible. On the other side of the glade there was a single tall fir tree, which attracted my attention because its trunk and lower branches were discoloured, as if a large fire had recently been lit underneath it. A clump of bushes grew in front of it, which concealed the base. Well, as I looked towards it, I was surprised to see projecting above the bush, and fastened apparently to the tree, a pair of fine riding boots, with the toes upwards. At first I thought that they were tied there, but as I looked harder I saw that they were secured by a great nail, which was hammered through the foot of each. And then, suddenly, with a thrill of horror, I understood that these were not empty boots, and moving my head a little to the right, I was able to see who it was that had been fastened there, and why a fire had been lit beneath the tree. It is not pleasant to speak or to think of horrors, my friends, and I do not wish to give any of you bad dreams tonight. But I cannot take you among the Spanish guerrillas without showing you what kind of men they were, and the sort of warfare that they waged. I will only say that I understood why Monsieur Vidal's horse was waiting masterless in the grove, and that I hoped he had met this terrible fate with sprightliness and courage, as a good Frenchman ought. It was not a very cheering sight for me, as you can imagine. When I had been with their chief in the grotto, I had been so carried away by my rage at the cruel death of young Soubiran, who was one of the brightest lads who ever threw his thigh over a charger, that I had never given a thought to my own position. Perhaps it would have been more politic had I spoken the ruffian fair, but it was too late now. The cork was drawn, and I must drain the wine. Besides, if the harmless commissariat man were put to such a death, what hope was there for me, who had snapped the spine of their lieutenant? No, I was doomed in any case, and it was as well, perhaps, that I should have put the best face on the matter. This beast could bear witness that Étienne Gérard had died as he had lived, and that one prisoner at least had not quailed before him. I lay there thinking of the various girls who would mourn for me, and of my dear old mother, and of the deplorable loss which I should be, both to my regiment and to the Emperor. And I am not ashamed to confess to you that I shed tears as I thought of the general consternation which my premature end would give rise to. But all the time I was taking the very keenest notice of everything which might possibly help me. I am not a man who would lie like a sick horse, waiting for the farrier sergeant and the pole-axe. First I would give a little tug at my ankle cords, and then another at those which were round my wrists. And all the time that I was trying to loosen them, I was peering round to see if I could find something which was in my favour. There was one thing which was very evident. A hussar is but half-formed without a horse. And there was my other half quietly grazing within 30 yards of me. Then I observed yet another thing. The path by which we had come over the mountains was so steep that a horse could only be led across it slowly and with difficulty. But in the other direction the ground appeared to be more open and to lead straight down into a gently sloping valley. Had I but my feet in yonder stirrups, and my sabre in my hand, a single bold dash might take me out of the power of these vermin of the rocks. I was still thinking it over, and straining with my wrists and my ankles, when their chief came out from his grotto, and after some talk with his lieutenant, who lay groaning near the fire, they both nodded their heads and looked across at me. He then said some few words to the band, who clapped their hands and laughed uproariously. Things looked ominous, and I was delighted to feel that my hands were so far free that I could easily slip them through the cords if I wished. But with my ankles I feared that I could do nothing, for when it strained it brought such pain into my lance wound that I had to gnaw my moustache to keep from crying out. I could only lie still, half free and half bound, and see what turn things were likely to take. For a little I could not make out what they were after. One of the rascals climbed up a well-grown fir tree upon one side of the glade and tied a rope round the top of the trunk. He then fastened another rope in the same fashion to a similar tree upon the other side. The two loose ends were now dangling down, and I waited with some curiosity, and just a little trepidation also, to see what they would do next. The whole band pulled upon one of the ropes, until they had bent the strong young tree down into a semicircle, and they then fastened it to a stump, so as to hold it so. When they had bent the other tree down in a similar fashion, the two summits were within a few feet of each other, though, as you understand, they would each spring back into their original position the instant that they were released. I already saw the diabolical plan which these miscreants had formed. "I presume that you are a strong man, Colonel," said the chief, coming towards me with his hateful smile. "If you will have the kindness to loosen these cords," I answered, "I will show you how strong I am." "We were all interested to see whether you were as strong as these two young saplings," said he. "It is our intention, you see, to tie one end of each rope round your ankles and then let the trees go. If you are stronger than the trees, then of course no harm would be done. If, on the other hand, the trees are stronger than you, why, in that case, Colonel, we may have a souvenir of you upon each side of our little glade." He laughed as he spoke, and at the sight of it the whole 40 of them laughed also. Even now, in my darker humour, or if I have a touch of my old Lithuanian ague. I see in my sleep that ring of dark savage faces with their cruel eyes and the firelight flashing upon their strong white teeth. It is astonishing, and I have heard many make the same remark, how acute one's senses become at such a crisis as this. I am convinced that at no moment is one living so vividly, so acutely, as at the instant when a violent and foreseen death overtakes one. I could smell the resinous faggots. I could see every twig upon the ground. I could hear every rustle of the branches, as I have never smelled or seen or heard, save at such times of danger. And so it was that long before anyone else, before even the time when the chief had addressed me, I had heard a low, monotonous sound, far away indeed, and yet coming nearer at every instant. At first it was but a murmur, a rumble. But by the time he had finished speaking, while the assassins were untying my ankles in order to lead me to the scene of my murder, I heard, as plainly as ever I heard anything in my life, the clinking of the horseshoes and the jingling of bridle chains, with the clank of sabres against stirrup irons. Is it likely that I, who had lived with the light cavalry since the first hair shaded my lip, would mistake the sound of troopers on the march? "Help, comrades, help!" I shrieked. And though they struck me across the mouth and tried to drag me up to the trees, I kept on yelling, "Help me, my brave boys! Help me, my children! They are murdering your colonel!" For the moment, my wounds and my troubles had brought on a delirium, and I looked for nothing less than my 500 hussars, kettle drums and all, to appear at the opening of the glade. But that which really appeared was very different to anything which I had conceived. Into the clear space there came galloping a fine young man upon a most beautiful roan horse. He was fresh-faced and pleasant-looking, with the most debonair bearing in the world, and the most gallant way of carrying himself, a way which reminded me somewhat of my own. He wore a singular coat, which had once been red all over, but which was now stained to the colour of a withered oak leaf, wherever the weather could reach it. His shoulder straps, however, were of golden lace, and he had a bright metal helmet upon his head, with a coquettish white plume upon one side of its crest. He trotted his horse up the glade, while behind him rode four cavaliers in the same dress, all clean-shaven, with round, comely faces, looking to me more like monks than dragoons. At a short, gruff order they halted, with a rattle of arms, while their leader cantered forward, the fire beating upon his eager face and the beautiful head of his charger. I knew, of course, by the strange coats, that they were English. It was the first sight I had ever had of them. But from their stout bearing and their masterful way, I could see at a glance that what I had always been told was true, and that they were excellent people to fight against. "Well, well, well," cried the young officer, in sufficiently bad French, "what game are you up to here? Who was that who was yelling for help? And what are you trying to do to him?" It was at that moment that I learned to bless those months which O'Brien, the descendant of the Irish kings, had spent in teaching me the tongue of the English. My ankles had just been freed, so that I only had to slip my hands out of the cords, and with a single rush I had flown across, picked up my sabre where it lay by the fire, and hurried myself onto the saddle of poor Vidal's horse. Yes, for all my wounded ankle, I never put foot to stirrup, but was in the seat in a single bound. I tore the halter from the tree, and before these villains could so much as snap a pistol at me, I was beside the English officer. "I surrender to you, sir," I cried, though I dare say my English was not very much better than his French. "If you will look at that tree to the left, you will see what these villains do to the honourable gentlemen who fall into their hands." The fire had flared up at that moment, and there was poor Vidal exposed before them, as horrible an object as one could see in a nightmare.
"God damn!" cried the officer, and "God damn!" cried each of the four troopers, which is the same as with us when we cry, "Mon Dieu!"
Out rasped the five swords, and the four men closed up. One who wore a sergeant's chevrons laughed and clapped me on the shoulder.
"Fight for your skin, froggy," said he.
Ah, it was so fine to have a horse between my thighs and a weapon in my grip. I waved it above my head and shouted in my exultation. The chief had come forward with that odious smiling face of his.
"Your Excellency will observe that this Frenchman is our prisoner," said he.
"You are a rascally robber," said the Englishman, shaking his sword at him. "It is a disgrace to us to have such allies. By my faith, if Lord Wellington were of my mind, we would swing you up on the nearest tree."
"But my prisoner," said the brigand in his suave voice.
"He shall come with us to the British camp.
Just a word in your ear before you take him."
He approached the young officer, and then, turning as quick as a flash, he fired his pistol in my face. The bullet scored its way through my hair and burst a hole on each side of my busby. Seeing that he had missed me, he raised the pistol and was about to hurl it at me, when the English sergeant, with a single backhanded cut, nearly severed his head from his body. His blood had not reached the ground, nor the last curse died on his lips, before the whole horde was upon us. But with a dozen bounds and as many slashes, we were all safely out of the glade and galloping down the winding track which led to the valley. It was not until we had left the ravine far behind us and were right out in the open fields that we ventured to halt and to see what injuries we had sustained. For me, wounded and weary as I was, my heart was beating proudly, and my chest was nearly bursting my tunic to think that I, Etienne Gerard, had left this gang of murderers so much by which to remember me. My faith, they would think twice before they ventured again to lay hands upon one of the third hussars. So carried away was I that I made a small oration to these brave Englishmen and told them who it was that they had helped to rescue. I would have spoken of glory also and of the sympathies of brave men, but the officer cut me short. "That's all right," said he. "Any injuries, Sergeant?"
"Trooper Jones's horse hit with a pistol bullet on the fetlock."
"Trooper Jones to go with us. Sergeant Halliday with troopers Harvey and Smith to keep to the right until they touch the vedettes of the German hussars."
So these three jingled away together, while the officer and I, followed at some distance by the trooper whose horse had been wounded, rode straight down in the direction of the English camp. Very soon we had opened our hearts, for we each liked the other from the beginning. He was of the nobility, this brave lad, and he had been sent out scouting by Lord Wellington to see if there were any of the signs of our advancing through the mountains. It is one advantage of a wandering life like mine that you learn to pick up those bits of knowledge which distinguish the man of the world. I have, for example, hardly ever met a Frenchman who could repeat an English title correctly. If I had not travelled, I should not be able to say with confidence that this young man's real name was Milor the Hon. Sir Russell Bart, this last being an honourable distinction, so that it was as the Bart that I usually addressed him, just as in Spanish one might say the Don. As we rode beneath the moonlight, in the lovely Spanish night, we spoke our minds to each other as if we were brothers. We were both of an age, you see, both of the light cavalry also. The 16th Light Dragoons was his regiment, and both with the same hopes and ambitions. Never have I learned to know a man so quickly as I did the Bart. He gave me the name of a girl whom he had loved at a garden called Vauxhall, and for my own part
I spoke to him of little Coralie, of the opera. He took a lock of hair from his bosom, and I a garter. Then we nearly quarrelled over hussar and dragoon, for he was absurdly proud of his regiment, and you should have seen him curl his lip and clap his hand to his hilt when I said that I hoped it might never be its misfortune to come in the way of the third. Finally, he began to speak about what the English call sport, and he told such stories of the money which he had lost, over which of two cocks could kill the other, or which of two men could strike the other the most in a fight for a prize, that I was filled with astonishment. He was ready to bet upon anything in the most wonderful manner. And when I chanced to see a shooting star, he was anxious to bet that he would see more than me. 25 francs a star, and it was only when I explained that my purse was in the hands of the brigands that he would give over the idea. Well, we chatted away in this very amiable fashion until the day began to break, when suddenly we heard a great volley of musketry from somewhere in front of us. It was very rocky and broken ground, and I thought, although I could see nothing, that a general engagement had broken out. The Bart laughed at my idea, however, and explained that the sound came from the English camp, where every man emptied his piece each morning, so as to make sure of having a dry priming. "In another mile we shall be up with the outposts," said he. I glanced round at this, and I perceived that we had trotted along at so good a pace during the time that we were keeping up our pleasant chat that the dragoon with the lame horse was altogether out of sight. I looked on every side, but in the whole of that vast rocky valley there was no one save only the Bart and I, both of us armed, you understand, and both of us well mounted. I began to ask myself whether, after all, it was quite necessary that I should ride that mile, which would bring me to the British outposts. Now, I wish to be very clear with you on this point, my friends, for I would not have you think that I was acting dishonourably or ungratefully to the man who had helped me away from the brigands. You must remember that of all duties, the strongest is that which a commanding officer owes to his men. You must also bear in mind that war is a game which is played under fixed rules, and when these rules are broken, one must at once claim the forfeit. If, for example, I had given a parole, then I should have been an infamous wretch had I dreamed of escaping. But no parole had been asked of me. Out of overconfidence, and the chance of the lame horse dropping behind, the Bart had permitted me to get upon equal terms with him. Had it been I who had taken him, I should have used him as courteously as he had me, but at the same time I should have respected his enterprise so far as to have deprived him of his sword, and seen that I had at least one guard beside myself. I reined up my horse and explained this to him, asking him at the same time whether he saw any breach of honour in my leaving him. He thought about it, and several times repeated that which the English say when they mean mon Dieu. "You would give me the slip, would you?" said he, "if you can give no reason against it." "The only reason that I can think of," said the Bart, "is that I should instantly cut your head off if you were to attempt it." "Two can play at that game, my dear Bart," said I. "Then we'll see who can play it best," he cried, pulling out his sword. I had drawn mine also, but I was quite determined not to hurt this admirable young man who had been my benefactor. "Consider," said I, "you say that I am your prisoner. I might with equal reason say that you are mine. We are alone here, and though I have no doubt that you are an excellent swordsman, you can hardly hope to hold your own against the best blade in the 6 light cavalry brigades." His answer was a cut at my head. I parried and shore off half of his white plume. He thrust at my breast. I turned his point and cut away the other half of his cockade. "Curse your monkey tricks," he cried, as I wheeled my horse away from him. "Why should you strike at me?" said I.
You see that I will not strike back.
That's all very well, said he. But you've got to come along with me to the camp.
I shall never see the camp, said I.
I'll lay you 9 to 4, you do,
he cried, as he made at me, sword in hand. But those words of his put something new into my head. Could we not decide the matter in some better way than fighting? The Bart was placing me in such a position that I should have to hurt him, or he would certainly hurt me. I avoided his rush, though his sword point was within an inch of my neck.
I have a proposal, I cried. We shall throw dice as to which is the prisoner of the other.
He smiled at this. It appealed to his love of sport.
Where are your dice? He cried.
I have none.
Nor I. But I have cards.
Cards let it be, said I. And the game?
I leave it to you.
Écarté, then. The best of three.
I could not help smiling as I agreed, for I do not suppose that there were three men in France who were my masters at the game. I told the Bart as much as we dismounted. He smiled also as he listened.
I was counted the best player at Watier's, said he.
With even luck, you deserve to get off if you beat me.
So we tethered our two horses and sat down, one on either side of a great flat rock. The Bart took a pack of cards out of his tunic, and I had only to see him shuffle to convince me that I had no novice to deal with. We cut, and the deal fell to him. My faith, it was a stake worth playing for. He wished to add 100 gold pieces a game. But what was money when the fate of Colonel Etienne Gérard hung upon the cards? I felt as though all those who had reason to be interested in the game, my mother, my hussars, the 6th Corps d'Armée, Ney, Massena, even the Emperor himself, were forming a ring round us in that desolate valley. Heavens, what a blow to one and all of them, should the cards go against me. But I was confident, for my écarté play was as famous as my swordsmanship, and save old Bouvet of the Hussars of Bercheny, who won 76 out of 150 games off me, I have always had the best of a series. The first game I won right off, though I must confess that the cards were with me, and that my adversary could have done no more. In the second, I never played better, and saved a trick by a finesse. But the Bart voled me once, marked the king, and ran out in the second hand. My faith, we were so excited that he laid his helmet down beside him, and I, my busby.
"I'll lay my roan mare against your black horse," said he.
"Done," said I.
"Sword against sword."
"Done," said I.
"Saddle, bridle, and stirrups," he cried.
"Done," I shouted.
I had caught this spirit of sport from him. I would have laid my hussars against his dragoons, had they been ours to pledge. And then began the game of games. Oh, he played, this Englishman, he played in a way that was worthy of such a stake. But I, my friends, I was superb. Of the five which I had to make to win, I gained 3 on the first hand. The Bart bit his moustache and drummed his hands, while I already felt myself at the head of my dear little rascals. On the second I turned the king, but lost 2 tricks, and my score was 4 to his 2. When I saw my next hand, I could not but give a cry of delight. If I cannot gain my freedom on this, thought I deserve to remain for ever in chains. Give me the cards, landlord, and I will lay them out on the table for you. Here was my hand, knave and ace of clubs, queen and knave of diamonds, and king of hearts. Clubs were trumps, mark you, and I had but 1 point between me and freedom. He knew it was the crisis, and he undid his tunic. I threw my dolman on the ground. He led the 10 of spades. I took it with my ace of trumps, 1 point in my favour. The correct play was to clear the trumps, and I led the knave. Down came the queen upon it, and the game was equal.
He led the eight of spades, and I could only discard my queen of diamonds. Then came the seven of spades, and the hair stood straight up on my head. We each threw down a king at the final. He had won 2 points, and my beautiful hand had been mastered by his inferior one. I could have rolled on the ground as I thought of it. They used to play very good écarté at Watier's in the year 10. I say it, I, Brigadier Gérard. The game was now 4-all. This next hand must settle it one way or the other. He undid his sash, and I put away my sword belt. He was cool, this Englishman, and I tried to be so also. But the perspiration would trickle into my eyes. The deal lay with him, and I may confess to you, my friends, that my hands shook so that I could hardly pick my cards from the rock. But when I raised them, what was the first thing that my eyes rested upon? It was the king, the glorious king of trumps. My mouth was open to declare it, when the words were frozen upon my lips by the appearance of my comrade. He held his cards in his hand, but his jaw had fallen, and his eyes were staring over my shoulder with the most dreadful expression of consternation and surprise. I whisked round, and I was myself amazed at what I saw. 3 men were standing quite close to us, 15 meters at the farthest. The middle one was of a good height, and yet not too tall, about the same height, in fact, that I am myself. He was clad in a dark uniform with a small cocked hat and some sort of white plume upon the side. But I had little thought of his dress. It was his face, his gaunt cheeks, his beak-like nose, his masterful blue eyes, his thin, firm slit of a mouth, which made one feel that this was a wonderful man, a man of a million. His brows were tied into a knot, and he cast such a glance at my poor Bart from under them that one by one the cards came fluttering down from his nerveless fingers. Of the 2 other men, one, who had a face as brown and hard as though it had been carved out of old oak, wore a bright red coat, while the other, a fine portly man with bushy side whiskers, was in a blue jacket with gold facings. Some little distance behind, 3 orderlies were holding as many horses, and an escort of dragoons was waiting in the rear.
"Hey, Crawford, what the deuce is this?" asked the thin man.
"Do you hear, sir?"
cried the man with the red coat.
"Lord Wellington wants to know what this means."
My poor Bart broke into an account of all that had occurred, but that rock face never softened for an instant.
"Pretty fine, upon my word, General Crawford," he broke in. "The discipline of this force must be maintained, sir. Report yourself at headquarters as a prisoner."
It was dreadful to me to see the Bart mount his horse and ride off with hanging head. I could not endure it. I threw myself before this English general. I pleaded with him for my friend. I told him how I, Colonel Gérard, would witness what a dashing young officer he was. Ah, my eloquence might have melted the hardest heart. I brought tears to my own eyes, but none to his. My voice broke, and I could say no more.
"What weight do you put on your mules, sir, in the French service?" he asked.
Yes, that was all this phlegmatic Englishman had to answer to these burning words of mine. That was his reply to what would have made a Frenchman weep upon my shoulder.
"What weight on a mule?" asked the man with the red coat.
210 pounds, said I.
"Then you load them deucedly badly," said Lord Wellington. "Remove the prisoner to the rear."
His dragoons closed in upon me. And I was driven mad, as I thought that the game had been in my hands, and that I ought at that moment to be a free man. I held the cards up in front of the general.
"See, my lord," I cried, "I played for my freedom, and I won, for, as you perceive, I hold the king."
For the first time, A slight smile softened his gaunt face.
"On the contrary," said he, as he mounted his horse, "it is I who won. For, as you perceive, my king holds you."
That is the end of How the Brigadier Held the King, from The Exploits of Brigadier Gerard by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, read by Greg Wagland for Magpie Audio 2024. Thank you for listening.